This is CliffCentral.com.
That's something happy for a Tuesday. It's just before 8 o'clock. Time for a live interview. And this morning, I'm very, very happy to have Ruda Landman in. We know Ruda from all of her interviews. We've all been a part of her incredible media career. And she seems to be taking it in interesting new directions. I see she's published a new book, which is something I took a look at for the first time last week. It's called Tell Me Your Story, which is a colorful mosaic of experience which emerges from the book as people share stories about change, changing careers, coming out, losing a partner, following a calling. And there are people in this book who've been interviewed by Ruda who I think you'd be very interested in too. John Carney, Feriel Hafiji, Peter Dirk Ace, Katlego Maboy, Gugu Zulu, Zapiro, Mam Kanyi, Arno Carstens, Proverb, Nick Benedel, Mark Lottering, and that's just to name a few. So I think that this is probably one that you should consider taking a look at if you're one of those people who's interested in change. If you're interested in the stories behind why people take on challenges and changes in a good way and usually in a positive way that results in interesting things for them as opposed to seeing change as a problem. And of course, we all hate change. That's how human nature has styled us. But some people just deal with it better than others. I suppose that's why Ruda is the person at the center of all of this. She's co-anchored the top investigative news programs in South Africa for 19 years. She's hosted for Anadinga on CakeNet and Talking Change on Bright Rock's website. She's a non-executive director of Media 24. And we love having her in here. How are you, Ruda?
Very well. Thank you for having me.
It's always nice to see you. I always feel like we know each other better than we know each other because I don't see you that often. But, you know, you've kind of been part of so many of our lives because you've had this presence in the media, even when you've taken in a direction that wasn't mainstream and done things that were out of the ordinary. It seems to me that you've always been familiar to most South Africans because you're also one of those people that we trust. When we see your face and your reputation involved in something, we usually go, ah, this is credible.
My daughter-in-law says when she was growing up, they used to say, if you wanted to end an argument, you said, Tani Ruda says so.
That's exactly right. Because people go, oh, well, I'm not arguing with her. You've worked on Veranderinge, which is really about change with Bright Rock for a while now, and you've interviewed some amazing people. Do you think I was right to say that people don't like change?
Yes, it's unsettling and it's often unhappy making. Mm. But the one thing I found was, you know, when I start thinking about these these conversations that I've had with all these people, the only way to deal with change is to say, okay, I hate this, but this is the new reality now.
Right.
As long as you're saying it shouldn't be like this, then... You're fighting the tide. If you want to kick against something, you have to stay with it. You have to stay close enough to be able to kick it. It is only when you say, okay, right, can't do anything about it, and you turn your back on it, there's a new reality, there are new possibilities.
Yeah, I often feel sorry for people who, in political terms, are what we would call reactionary. They want things to go back to a time that is over. They want things to change back to something that was more familiar to them, to perhaps a time when it suited them better. And you feel that these people are frustrating themselves so often. And in South Africa, sometimes the reactionaries are in places you wouldn't expect them to be. They call themselves radicals. They're thinking about tomorrow, but actually they're thinking about a yesterday that never happened, but they believe somewhere in their deepest, darkest soul that was where they would be happier. I feel sorry for people who aren't able to let go. And in these interviews, you must have touched on that with a couple of people. You must have found that there were lessons in that intransigence that some people seem to be able to never escape from.
You know, John Carney was so interesting because most of us probably, I can't say that. Let me speak for myself. The whole transition of the, it's not just 94, it's that whole period, is such a, uplifting, happy-making thought for me.
Right.
And here I was with John, who's about 10 years older than I am. So he was about 10 years further down the line. And I asked him, okay, how did you experience it? Thinking with a kind of, oh, he's going to say it was so fantastic.
That halo effect.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't.
And he said, and it was a moment in the conversation. He looked at me and he said, Ruda, I was so angry. And I went, what? And he said, I walked in and I made my little X. And I walked out and I thought, it cannot be this easy. It was too hard. It was too big. My brother was murdered. So many people spent so many years in jail and tortured and whatever. It cannot be this easy. And it took him about 8 years until 2002 when he'd written a play about his brother. And he said, having seen the play on stage and having kind of almost relived the history through his own fiction, through his own work, he could then let go and move on.
He was exercising those demons.
Yes, yes.
Because I know a lot of people who didn't find that transition, didn't find that change in South Africa a pleasant experience. As much as they admit now that it was necessary and historically it was absolutely the right way to go and everything was done to the best of the abilities of the people in question at the time. And, you know, history with 2020 hindsight, obviously there's lots that you can improve on. But at the time, people were doing the best they could. I know lots of people who thought that was a mess, that they feel that it could have been done in a very different way that would have been perhaps a little bit more violent, that they think might have been a little bit more effective in some ways, that certain concessions were made by both sides that didn't need to be made. You know, you meet people who look back and they've still got a lot of anxiety about what happened. They've got a lot of bitterness and anger about what happened. And those people are also trapped.
Yeah.
They're not dealing with the change. And we've moved far beyond 94 now.
Mm. No, and if all of us can just grab what is possible in this country. You know, our new president said it in his first speech in Parliament. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought that the government, the GCIS, really missed an opportunity. It should have been on all the placards the next morning. Send me. Because that is the other possibility. Instead of saying, oh, it shouldn't be like this, it could have been much better. Had I been at the table in 92, 93, I would have been so much, you know, never have done that.
But those people are also, they're living in the past. And you can't change what has happened. What you can change is what is going to happen.
Yes.
And that word change.
You can help build it.
That word change is both a verb and an adjective. Mm-hmm. I mean, you make change happen. So when you talk to all these people, and you actually had a bird's eye view of this in so many ways, because you were in the news media, you were in the current affairs business. So during that period of our history, you got to see it from a little bit more of an objective point of view than the rest of us. You were in it because it's obviously your country and you were experiencing this day by day. But you also had access to people who were the change agents. Mm. And you had access to information in a much more comprehensive sense than most of us did. You had to know.
It was my job to know. You know, most people have different jobs and they just are aware of what's happening kind of on the fringes of their consciousness. Journalists it is our job to be aware, to look through a wider lens. You know, my husband always, who's a political and economic analyst, he always says, don't look at the snapshot, look at the film. And I think that is something that we can all take note of.
Well, especially in this modern world of 140 to 280 characters on Twitter and, you know, an image or a piece of rhetoric that some politician has spewed out. No one's really doing the heavy lifting the way that they might have before. And I mean, that's probably not true too, because for a lot of people, now is the time of more information. This is an occasion where in human history, we've suddenly got this abundance of information. You can go on the internet and find out about anything you like. But do people go to that level?
Unfortunately, I think we're retreating into silos, and you access the information that you like in both the Facebook sense and the emotional sense.
Yeah, you're looking for what you like, but yes. You're also being given what you like by the media producers.
Yeah. So it's, but you know, I'm just thinking we're talking the political changes and external changes. Mm. The other incredibly moving thing that I came across in these conversations, of course, are people's personal journey. Letshego Zulu, who's absolutely astonishing, amazing husband, Gugu, died on Kilimanjaro. Mm-hmm. Gugu Zulu was, I say that in the introduction to that interview, he was simply one of the most attractive people I've ever met, both physically, but also in his, just in his energy, in the way he was in the world. And I totally fell for him. And then a year later, he was dead.
Yeah.
And Letshego had to carry on.
Well, she's a strong human being.
And, you know, with her, I could hear the story that she told about, of course, how difficult it was and how she was kind of caught, you can just imagine, in that blackness. But then she had to say, well, I have a one-year-old.
Yeah.
I have to not turn away from what was, accept that he's dead, that I will never see him again, and go forward, because there's a life to be lived.
And for someone so young to have to face that stuff on her own, pretty much, because the only other person in that situation was him.
Yeah.
And there's this child now who needs you. I mean, when she came in and told us the story, it was about a few months later. And we also had a similar experience to you. So, I mean, across, you know, 2 points on the graph, we must be close to the truth of what Letshego is really like and what she's gone through. But I agree with you about Gugu. I mean, there are incredible people out there. And you never know when a change moment's going to come. Sometimes you can plan it.
Mm.
Sometimes if it's a career choice, or if it's to do with the meta stuff that we're talking about, the politics, the economics, the family planning, those kinds of things. Some people are very good at managing their change. But other changes you have no say over. And those are the tough ones. Those are the ones that hit you right between the eyes.
That is true. But the for some reason, what comes to mind is Katlego Maboy,
mm-hmm.
who I just find, I was talking to someone last night and she said, it struck her that reading John Carney's interview and then reading Katlego's interview, that Katlego has no anger. There's just a positive energy going forward.
No, he is.
And I said, you know, Katlego is one of the, is an example, what's the word, exemplar of being ready and then the door opens. Or I said to her, he learned to surf at Potchefstroom Central as a primary school boy, and now the wave is coming.
Right.
And he's up there, and he's just riding it. But with such responsibility, he's not just floating. He's controlling and thinking and doing it so consciously.
Were there characteristics like the one you're describing now in Katlego, were there characteristics across the board that you noticed in these people? Because most of them have navigated change well.
Mm.
Most of them have got experiences we could all benefit from learning from. So was there a common golden thread between these people that made you think, because you could have interviewed losers, you could have gone out and done interviews with people who had responded badly to change, people who had failed, people who had willfully given up accountability and responsibility for their own actions. We know lots of people like that in South Africa, and they will find everyone else to blame for the fact that their lives are not working out and that things are conspiring against them. But you didn't. You chose to speak to winners. So what is it about these people that makes them successful? What is it about them that makes them navigate change well?
Well, you've actually answered your own question. It is taking responsibility. It is saying, okay, so there are things that I cannot control, but I can control my response. And I will not say that life or the world or other people or whatever have done this to me. I will just say, okay, this is where I am. How am I going to handle it? And that is up to me. And that makes all the difference.
But there are people, I appreciate that, and I think that you've articulated better than I did, but there are still people who will find reasons not to step up. And there will people who there are people who live so much in yesterday. Maybe they've got pain, maybe they were, you know, raised by parents who didn't care about them. Maybe they feel that the world is conspiring against them for whatever reason, and there may be legitimate or illegitimate reasons for that. It doesn't matter in the end, because at that moment of taking responsibility for yourself, you really have all the options available to you. Because before that decision, you are a victim.
Yeah. No, as long as you choose to be a victim, you cut off your own hands. You give away your power and your energy because you're saying that I can't do this. Ek kan nie help nie. Dit is nou so. Ek kan nie help nie. We can all help. It's because, as I say, you control your response. Whatever happens from outside, your response is in your own hands. I mean, Viktor Frankl said that about the concentration camps.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit of an extreme example.
But that's where that's what I was thinking about when you were saying just now this thing about accountability. Which book of his is it? Viktor Frankl. It's on my bedside table right now. That's why I'm thinking
really?
About it.
Really?
So, yeah. So interesting you mentioned him. With these various people that you've spoken to and these interviews that you've had and these conversations which are now in book form, which I think for a lot of people is still something that is a priority. Mm-hmm. A lot of people make time to read. You do. I know you read a fortune. Do you separate them into very serious things and not so serious things, or are they all equally important to you, these change moments? Because for some people it's getting married, for some people it's starting a business, for some people it's divorce or death, for some people it's coming out, for some people it's doing something that no one else has done before, pioneering. Do you separate them out in your mind, or do you just tell the people's stories?
Not, I don't separate it. And that is actually the brilliant thing about the platform that Bright Rock has provided me on the Change Exchange, that I don't have to separate. I don't have to
rank it,
make a hierarchy. I sit there and I say, tell me your story. And whether it's Nick Minadel, who goes from living overseas and realizing that this is not my place, this is not my homeland in my heart, I want to go back. Same with Angel Johnson. That was also an interesting, you know, some of us have opportunities outside and there's a conscious decision that you want to be here. There's that wonderful quote that opens the book, Anton Rupert saying, and it was actually in conversation with my husband, with JP, that JP asked him, if you want to live close to the office, you should be in Switzerland.
Yeah.
Why do you live in South Africa?
Right.
And he said, here my life makes a difference.
Huh.
And, you know, there's something of that in Angel's story, in Nick's story, even someone like John Carney. I mean, John could have gone.
He could have. He had the talent.
So
the reputation.
Where was I going? Oh, to the whole thing of just tell me your story. Because with Bright Rock, one of the change moments they want to focus on is when you meet your partner.
Right.
So that gave me an opening to really just get through into people's hearts, because they knew ahead of time, you know, in arranging the interview, it was clear that we are going to talk about that. Dan Nichols started crying. I asked him,
but he's a wimp. I mean,
how did you meet your wife? And he told me he just kind of, there was a moment of silence, and then he started crying and told me the story of how she, I still have the picture in my head, she got off a bus and he saw her and he decided
that's the girl I'm going to marry.
She's the one. You know, Mark Lottering, who just stole my heart completely. You know, his whole story of coming out with a pastor for a dad.
Yeah.
And growing up in a really conservative environment. And how he said that at 30, he came out for a whole year. I mean, over a period of a year.
Oh. And,
he drew it out. And, you know, for him to not be funny. And he is funny, even when he's talking about serious things.
Yes, yes.
But you can also, you can tell when he's letting you in.
There's a deeply serious strain.
A lot of comedians are deflecting the whole time, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It was interesting. Peter Dirk Eis, he gave me a beautiful interview, but I didn't feel that I got to his heart. He controls what he tells you. And what he shows. With Mark, I felt that he was so open. It was quite interesting. And I'm not saying that Peter Dirk, you know, that he wasn't honest or anything
Or fascinating.
It's just, or fascinating. It's just that he's controlled. He's very careful.
It might be generational.
There's
a part of that. I mean, I was going to ask you, what is it about you that you think makes people open up like this?
I listen. It is a rare skill.
And you jumped to it straight away. Most people would have demurred longer, but you're absolutely right. You do listen. I can see you take in everything, and you don't necessarily spit out an answer.
Mm.
You're actually just processing it and sometimes just letting it come. That doesn't have to have a conclusion, right?
No, and it's very often at Carte Blanche still, I remember that there were times, you know, the wonderful thing about the way Carte Blanche works, and I'm sure there are other examples, is that you shoot beforehand so you can let the interview happen and it can be as long as it takes. Mm-hmm. It's not under pressure, live, and you only have 7 minutes.
Right.
It's a...
No, which is what you've got today. You've got these soundbite news reports.
Yeah. So, and I remember, for example, doing an interview long time ago with two sisters who had taken their stepfather to court for abuse 20 years after the fact.
Hmm.
Now, they had lived, they had found a way of existing, of living, by keeping quiet for 20 years. And now, okay, they have said that they will talk. But it doesn't come easily.
Mm.
And they were not articulate word people. And I remember that day sitting there was just listening, just letting them and seeing, and even just a one's shoulder would move if the other one said something. And I would say, I see this touches you. What does it tell me?
Yeah.
And there were long silences.
Which would be so awkward for a lot of people.
Yeah. When you talk, you don't hear anything.
True. How many of these change moments in your own life help to inform you when you're interviewing other people? I mean, are there seminal moments that you can relate to that make it easier for you to be able to pull that valuable information out of others?
I don't know.
I'm making you sound like you're this terrible investigator, but I mean, in conversation, this is a useful tool. The reason I'm asking is because you're one of those people who is a good listener. You're one of those people who does extract really useful information out of people. And I think that that's instructive to a lot of us who are listening. But do you use your own experience?
I'm sure I do subliminally. But I don't really think about it in the moment. Well, I do sometimes say, I mean, I remember years ago doing an interview with a self-confessed paedophile. It was one of the most difficult things I'd ever had to do because he targeted boys between the of about 9 to 12. My son was 10.
Oh.
And in that interview, I remember saying, and you see, if when you do an interview with someone, you have to park your preconceptions at the door. If you go in with...
This is a horrendous
what
human
are you,
being.
Do you
yeah.
know, what are you thinking?
I'm going to set this guy right. Yeah.
Then
it's not gonna
you
happen.
Get nothing. You no. get the superficial stuff, the kind of public stuff. It's only if you really try and enter into his world.
Yeah, but that takes some doing.
Whew, it was hard that day. But I remember actually looking at him at one point and saying, my son is 10. If you had done this to him, what would you say to me? And it broke through the defenses. So sometimes, yes, you bring your own, but it can get very twee and very... Yeah. Horrible. You must be very careful.
Have you ever felt in an interview or in a discussion with someone, and it might have been a professional one, or it might have been something that you were doing, you know, from research point of view. It might have been something that was never publicized, or it was, you know, kind of behind the scenes production stuff. Ever done one of those interviews and felt very uncomfortable afterwards? Thought I didn't need to do that interview. That was a waste of time. Because that sometimes happens too. Where you didn't get anything out of them, or you got something out of them that was very unpleasant and that wasn't necessary to make a decent production out of.
You know, it's a weird thing. I can't give you an example, but I have felt at times this listening thing. You can take people beyond what they really want to give.
And then they overshare?
Yes. And then both of you are deeply uncomfortable.
Or they end up saying something that gets them into criminal trouble, right? I mean, that could happen. You know, like you get a confession.
Yeah.
I don't know if you heard this interview. Judith O'Regan is a writer in America. She's published a number of books. She interviewed O.J. Simpson not so long ago. Now, this year. And in fact, I think she did the interview 10 years ago and she just kept it bottled because... He basically confesses in the interview, OJ. You know, he's sort of jocular about it, and he's not particularly careful about where he steps. He's written a book called If I Had to Do It. So the guy's, he's skirting the edge of, you know, he can't, in America, there's this thing called double jeopardy. So you can't actually
be tried twice
on the same crime. So he's safe from that point of view. But she did this incredible interview, and they've just republished it now. And it's suddenly come out where she gets him to pretty much tell the whole story. And it's very hard to listen to. It's hard to listen to. The OJ trial so long ago now. But when she asks him about what happened, I can't help getting angry hearing it. He's a deranged guy in some ways. He's like so many men who feel that they own their woman. There's a lot of anger and kind of this masculine aggression, which you can see manifested itself in what happened in that situation. But to hear it from the perpetrator in such...
And there's almost an element of boasting.
Yeah. That's what he was doing. Mm. And I got furious listening to this thing. I heard it 2 weekends ago and it drove me crazy. I can't tell you, and I'm not in any way connected to the OJ thing. I remember the story. It was in the news when I was at Varsity studying law. And I just thought, these interviews are sometimes so much more useful many years later. There's so many revelations that come out. If you think back on your career and the interviews and the conversations that you've had with people, are there moments where something meant more at the time but you didn't realize it, and then later on you went, but hang on a second, because you've got a good memory too. This person said that to me, now I understand.
I can't really say that. One would have to go back and think. But I do know that... I used to teach a two-week course at Stellenbosch in TV production at the Stellenbosch Journalism School. And there was one story that I used as an example, and it was the, you know, when Adrian Flock washed Frank Ciccone's feet. We did a story, and the interview that I did with him, it was interesting because as I remembered it, it was in 2006, as I remembered it, it was a, there was an element of hardness or harshness even. I remember saying to him, but this was on, because, you know, he was, we didn't know and the generals didn't tell me and la, la, la. And I said, but it was on your watch. And he did come back with whatever. But what interested me was the response of the students, because this was now 10 years later. And they just sat there and laughed at him.
Huh.
And I thought, we really have moved on.
Well, we
people
have.
Who were so powerful are now just
a joke.
You know, it's to be dismissed.
but there's also this. There seems to me, you mentioned earlier how we're becoming siloed about information. Mm. Now, I think that there are too few people who are interested in hearing from those bad guys, because the bad guys didn't think they were bad. And this is the problem with all of us, right? Look at Winnie Madikizela Mandela, who died just a little while ago. And there was a lot of revisionist history done about her. And there still will be. There's plenty to be written about Winnie's contributions and her transgressions in South Africa before and post-apartheid. But people are so swept up by the moment very often. And we like to make things simple. We like to put things in a box in our heads and be able to put it away.
And people are good or bad.
Right. I mean, you remember people because you probably interviewed people like, who was the chief of the, Magnus Malan, Pierre Vierbuerta, F.W. de Klerk when he was president. These are people who thought they were, you know, doing the right thing. They thought they were tremendously progressive at the time. And we look at them now. I kind of think also about the Nuremberg trials in Nazi Germany, well, post-Nazi Germany, 1945. And I think about how those people defended themselves and what they said about these obvious and revolting and egregious human rights abuses. And I think I want to know how they justified it in their heads. Yeah. That's more interesting to me than to say they're a bad person. Do you also find that? It's sometimes interesting to get into a controversial discussion with someone like that, so you can figure out how they slept at night, knowing what they were doing.
It's a very interesting and it makes one deeply uncomfortable to think about that there was a time when whatever slavery, the 1913 Land Act. Apartheid, when it wasn't bad people. I mean, they weren't bad in them, bad in themselves. They weren't psychopaths.
Mm.
It was people like you and me who put those acts in place. You know, I grew up as an Afrikaner believing that my people were honorable, eerbaar. It was the way we saw ourselves. And it was one of the most difficult things for me personally in the 90s to actually comprehend what my people as the leaders, because I don't, you know, it's not only them, of course, but taking it on as the, because they were the leaders, had done, and to really understand that. But someone said to me the other day, but in 1913, the white people did not think it was wrong to pass the Land Act and chase black people off the farms. And I just sit there and I think, but how could you not?
Yeah.
You know, but Jefferson had slaves.
And if you read any book from even 40 years ago, 40 years ago, you pick up a book and you think, how are they talking about people like this? People. Whoever wrote this book, and these are, you know, the people who were writing books, the academics, the learned people.
In 1952, someone got a license in what is now Namibia to shoot X number of eland and X number of whatever and X number and one bushman.
Could shoot them like a fauna. Well, even in Australia, that was what happened.
So it's a really difficult thing to work with. Right and wrong and absolutes and not.
Well, that's why it's, if you're really interested in this stuff, you do have to read a lot more. You have to listen a lot more than you talk. And for most of us, that's impossible because we can't dedicate the time to it, first of all. And maybe we can, but we're lazy.
Yeah, and it's uncomfortable to hear something that doesn't gel with your view of the world. It's uncomfortable.
Those are the things you should seek out.
But that's part of why I wanted these interviews presented in one whole. Because we are so diverse in South Africa, and I think it's one of the pluses of the country, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But we need to get out of our boxes and hear other people's stories. Patricia de Lille, who was born a year before me. Mm-hmm. We lived in the Northern Cape as young people, both of us. And her life experience is just so different. Her father had to stand on one leg with a pencil in his hair and jump up and down to determine whether they would be classified colored or black. And that would change their future forever. And this is someone my age.
Yeah.
We need to listen to each other's stories.
Well, I think it's a marvelous book. As I said to you, I started looking at it last week, and I've read parts of it that I find interesting. I always do that with books. You sort of pull out the pieces, but I'll give it a proper once over. It's well worth reading just from the point of view of understanding so much about these individuals, their stories, how they manage them, but also about our community, about the people that were the winners, the ones who've managed to navigate change positively and done impressive things in their lives as a result of that. Young, old, black, white, privileged, underprivileged, people who've come from incredible places with incredible ideas. And I think that this is a tremendous work. For you, it's also obviously taking all of this hard work that you've done and putting it into something that's a written document. That's quite hard, though.
It's enormously you're committing satisfying.
But it's tough because you're committing it to writing, and sometimes you lose in a video or an audio interview, you lose the tone.
Yes. I must say, looking at the video recordings of some of these while I was doing it, I did think, you know, there's a physical interaction that you, of course, lose on a page. But I think because we kept it so conversational, and I had a bit of a interaction with the publishers because they wanted to neaten it up more.
Yeah.
And I said, no. It must sound like it was. It must. People do not talk in full, neat sentences. We don't. We interrupt ourselves. We think about this. We think about that. And it must sound like that. So, I'm very happy with what we have.
Well, we were also announcing something that I think will be an interesting companion to this, and that is the podcast, Ruta Talks Change, where we've taken a number of these interviews and we've decided to draw that golden thread into certain of the stories, whether it was around relationships, around work, around children, around all of these things that affect people in the most obvious and meaningful ways through the course of their lives. And we're putting together a Ruta Talks Change podcast at cliffcentral.com along with Bright Rock. I think you're going to enjoy this too. So get the book. And then if you want to hear the tone, especially for people like Mark Lottering, when they're, you know, interesting and funny things that he says, you're not sure whether he's joking or whether he's being sarcastic or whether he's being serious some of the time. You can hear it in the tone of voice. We'll be putting out that podcast soon, so keep an eye out for it. And go and get Ruta's book, Tell Me Your Story, because I think you'll find maybe there's just one thing that gives you a handle on how to handle things that are going on in your life that have to do with change. Thank you.
I'm so excited about these podcasts. I think it's going to be really amazing, and I'm looking forward to helping you put it together and tie it up.
I'm more excited than you can believe. Yeah. This is going to be terrific. So it's something new for us as well in terms of taking content that you've already put together and reprocessing it and making it into stories that I think people will love and gravitate towards. And it's all coming up very, very soon. We'll let you know as soon as it's ready. And Ruda Talks Change, the podcast, Tell Me Your Story, the book, both will be available for your interest. And of course, the book is available right now. So you can go and get it at all good bookstores. And if you want to find out more, you can also go onto the internet. There's always plenty of information there. If you can't find it for some reason, maybe you're in some strange Northern Cape town that only Ruda knows about.
Poor father.
All right. Thank you so much, Ruda. It's a pleasure to see you. And thanks for coming to spend some time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Always time well spent. Ruda Landman, everybody. This is CliffCentral.com.